Welcome to Book Spectrum. I'm your host, Chris Cordani. This is where we talk with writers who aren't always seasoned career authors, but from occupations and professions across the spectrum. Harry Houdini's magic career and life were all fascinating. He escaped all kinds of restraints, encasements, and situations. Still, there was one thing even the great Houdini couldn't escape: his own mortality. That hit him at an early age back in 1926. Houdini did, however, say he would try. He reportedly told his wife, Bess, if there was any way out, I'm going to find it. I will find you, and I'll make contact with you on the anniversary of my death. While that never happened, the escape artist's fascination with spirituality and communication with those in the afterlife, from his attempts to contact his deceased mother through his own passing, provide the background to this highly intriguing what-if historical fiction book. It's called Houdini's Last Handcuffs, and with me are the authors, Charles C. Young and Cheryl L. Young. Charles, Cheryl, welcome to Book Spectrum.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be here.
Thank you for having us, Chris.
I'm glad to have you as well. I must make sure our audience knows that your father, Morris Young, was a stellar magician in his own right.
Yes, he was a major collector, did also perform some magic, but his profession was he was an eye surgeon. But early on, you know, he had developed an interest in things magical.
He was a magician, an eye surgeon, and definitely influenced by Houdini all around.
Correct. Right. Yeah, he had met the magician early in his career, and he became acquainted with one of Houdini's secretaries, who happened to be the author of the Shadow novels. You know, who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows. That was Walter Gibson, and they formed a partnership and wrote some books about Houdini. So he was very involved with that, and Walter took over from Bess, Houdini's wife, the tradition of doing seances yearly.
I would assume that Harry Houdini was pretty prominent throughout your childhood.
Yeah, absolutely. The home was steeped in magic. There were magic posters on the wall. There were items, one in particular, a pair of handcuffs that our father was fortunate to be given by Elsie Hardin, who was the widow of Houdini's brother, Hardin the magician. When Houdini died, he left all of his magic act to his brother because his brother was also a magician. And when Hardin died, The widow sold off a bunch of stuff, but then she invited my father and his collecting buddy to come in and clear up the last portions of the estate. And one of the absolute last pieces was this unusual pair of handcuffs.
So talk about these handcuffs. These are obviously Houdini's handcuffs, and we know we have the title of the book as Houdini's Handcuffs. So let's get into what you have.
Cheryl?
Well, I think the handcuffs, of course, are integral to the book and were a very important piece, especially Charlie still has them. And that in itself is part of it, but another major influence on this, on our knowledge of Houdini, was that every year there was a seance held to try and reach Houdini. And growing up with these seances going on, and later on, when we got older, we actually were able to sit and watch a seance. My parents, my father in particular, participated, and I think that itself was so intriguing that I've always wanted to reach Houdini, to have him come back again.
They were a major inspiration for writing this tale. Our father had written an article in 1992 for The Linking Ring, which is the major magazine of the International Brotherhood of Magicians. And he called that article The Last Handcuffs. Now, we named our book, inspired by that, Houdini's Last Handcuffs, because in the article, he describes finding the handcuffs and asking Elsie whether he could take them because he thought, well, they must be special because they had been tacked to a wall in the basement. And they'd been altered clearly by one of the brothers to make them easier to escape from. So they were magical in that sense. But our father felt that this was the last spore of the brothers Houdini leaving the Houdini estate. And that made them very special to him and why they were on show in our house when we were growing up and why he wrote the article about them. So they were a major inspiration for writing this tale.
I'm with Cheryl and Charles Young, the authors of Houdini's Last Handcuffs, right here on Book Spectrum. I'm Chris Cordani, your host. Let's get to the book, because in this particular story, one of those seances worked. When you were watching the seance, what were you thinking about this idea? Like, what would happen if, in fact, the seance worked?
Well, I think we were always hopeful, although I don't think most of us believed that it was possible. There was always that kernel of hope that perhaps we would reach him. In the tale, the adults are going off to Houdini's home to try to reach him with the seance, and Walter Gibson, the shadow rider, leaves the children with a Ouija board because the children are disappointed that they couldn't tag along. They were youngsters, 8, 9.
Oh, that's really smart. They're leaving kids with a Ouija board.
Well, we also did have, because, you know, these children really represent us in the tale. But we did have a housekeeper, a live-in housekeeper who was left with us. So we weren't totally alone, but we were left with this Ouija board. And Walter, you know, said, go ahead, see if you can contact him yourselves. Unbeknownst, though, to all of us, Houdini had actually already returned that evening, and he returned because of the magic in the handcuffs.
One would think that if anybody could be reached in a seance and brought back to life, resurrected, if you will, it would be Harry Houdini, the guy who would be able to escape his own, let's just say, demise.
Yes, and in the story, you know, he does return, and he makes a connection with the children. He enlists the children's help because he's returned with a purpose. He needs to find his special secret notebook that has formulas, one of which was the formula that he used to be able to return. But the formula was flawed, and that was one of the reasons for his return, to work on this formula again. But there were other formulae in the book. None of the book contained hocus pocus or, let's say, traditional magic. This was all in math and physics and different science formulas. And that's a really, you know, an important theme of the book, that real magic is actually science and physics making the seemingly impossible possible. And that's what we want to try to bring out. Houdini himself was a very learned man, and he used science to try to make some of his tricks actually successful too. So I think that's important that we understand that magic involves math and science. A lot of these tricks do.
Well, think about it. Look at the magicians of today and their high tech, their high tech illusions, their elaborate stage shows.
Right.
A lot of that requires mathematics and physics to make things happen. And to kind of twist things around and show people what they're seeing is what they're seeing, but it's not really happening. And still, that's the amazement. Well, remember when we were kids, it was always the math teacher saying, you're going to be able to use this when you're older. Kids were always asking, when am I going to use it when I'm older? Well, I'll tell you what, very important to note that almost every occupation requires math and science to some degree, magic to a heavy degree.
Absolutely. You know, I think that's very clear today that you need to be very sophisticated to design the tricks that we see the magicians are performing. And I was going to say so that physicians perform, and that historically, I think that's interesting that magic came about first, I guess, with religion and magic was tied into this, but it was the early alchemists that really started science, and it all began with magic becoming science. So this is a true transition of that historically.
Right, spitting base items into green, right? Like Lord Percy did on the Blackadder. That was a good one.
Spitting lead into gold.
There we go. Or green, as I said before, a nice, beautiful brooch made of pure green, if you will, purest green. Chris Cordani here. This is Book Spectrum. I have with me Cheryl and Charles Young. They wrote a book called Houdini's Last Handcuffs. It delves into a lot of things. We talked about math and science. We talked about Houdini. It's an historical fiction. You also take this to a spiritual level as well, where we look at the difference between good and evil, the fight with that, getting children involved who are generally innocent to join in this fight against evil. And yes, a look at one's own mind's journey as well.
The children, particularly Charlie in this tale, is very introspective and has talks with Houdini, trying to understand the nature of life and death. Where has Houdini been? And I'll say I'm not going to reveal that, but that's revealed in the story. He discusses where he's been. And there's a question of what is kind of the meaning of life. And also there's the importance of education to get us where we want to go.
It also important is why the children, and why does he come to the children and
right
in the first instance rather than to the adults. And I think that it's also an important part of us is to keep the freshness of the eyes of children. And
essentially, there's the thought that to be receptive to him, you needed that kind of mind, that the children were more open to believing in things than adults.
Readers of Houdini's Last Handcuffs will also find themselves through the story, through your story, raising questions perhaps about the mind itself, its potential, and how humans can learn to harness the power.
Yes, the one of the things that is brought out in here in the book that Houdini and also I think my father discuss, that ultimately what they're hoping to achieve is that the body is more of a battery for the mind, and ultimately we want to be able to have the mind exist on its own. And when that happens, the battery of the body essentially will no longer be essential, and the mind will being able to exist on its own, that there will be no death at that point.
Interesting point that you bring up, or you brought up a little earlier in the interview. The main characters are children. The idea that the adults went away, the kids were the ones able to bring Houdini back, is rather interesting in a lot of ways, because the thought is that, yes, children are not jaded by life or years of life by the time they're only maybe 6, 12, or 13. They are more open to believing things like the afterlife, or believing in something that they haven't seen.
And that's exactly what we say in the book, that this tale begins at the start when we're young, and that you have to have the mind of a youngster perhaps to be open enough to, and receptive enough to believe in things that adults think aren't real already.
Well, I hope they learn to go to math class too.
Yes.
I think that that adults also have a child within them. And so by us communicating with the adults, we were very precocious children. So in reality, our companions were each other and the guests that our parents had in the house, who are some of these characters in the book. So young children can communicate with adults in a way on an adult level, and there's some child in adults, and there doesn't really have to be a huge differentiation. And Houdini was our friend in the book, so he could have been a kid for it in our mind, but of course as an adult, he was the great Houdini. But for us, he was just, he was there. Suddenly he was there, and it was not, it wasn't like a freaking out experience. It was because you're, as a child, you're so open to these things, he could easily become part of our life.
Charles Sherrill in Houdini's Last Handcuffs. There is a lot of intrigue in this. There's your fight between good and evil and the idea of resurrection alone. But your story also looks into some real life situations like grifters in the medium field. And there are a lot of those. It's hard to separate the real ones from the grifters for a lot of people. Also personal reflection.
There is a discussion in the book. It is a historical fiction. And Houdini himself, although he wanted to believe, he also felt that all these or most of these mediums were false. And he spent a lot of his later life exposing these false mediums, but always with the hope that he would be able to reach across to the other side, that there might be a kernel of truth in it. It was a fad at the time in the 1920s. Spiritualism and mediums were popular throughout the country. It was so much so that, and there was so much belief that you could, that you were able to communicate with people in the afterlife, that Scientific American, that organization, that magazine, put together a committee to try to ascertain whether this was really true. Could we communicate with the dead? And they put on notable scientists and physicians and people of note, but they also added Houdini to this committee. And he felt that he was the only one really who was able to know the tricks, the shenanigans that he had learned early in life through sideshows to con artists, essentially, took people. And he went around and he actually, you know, did expose them. That was published. But again, all with the hope that he would ultimately find someone who really could communicate with the afterlife.
Or was it that the one thing that Houdini couldn't escape from is being assigned to a committee?
But he really did want to believe, and he exposed all the false people. But he did have a pact with his wife that if he could come back, he would. I mean, if there was anybody who could escape death, it was going to be Houdini, and she was the one who had the seances every year. And I believe she was 10 years, right, Charlie? That she actually did it every year. And then she just said, I can't do it anymore. I think the disappointment was too great. And she passed on the leadership role to Walter, our father's friend, who they wrote books together. And this didn't die out, though, with our parents and their generation. These seances are still going on today. It's something that people continue to have this hope that there is a link and that he will be back. And of course, for us, he did come back. So back.
That's the big one, though. That's the big one, though. There's always hope. And the reason why people want to look at the afterlife, we all want to believe there is one. We all have different ideas, maybe what it's going to be like. We want to believe it's there. We want to believe that we can communicate with our deceased relatives. And while it opens us up to grifters, it also opens us up to the idea that there is still a possibility.
Very true.
With me is Charles and Cheryl Moore. They're the authors of Houdini's Last Handcuffs. And they're in possession of Houdini's Last Handcuffs. So how about that? That's kind of pretty cool. Another thing I wanted to bring up about the book is I share your affinity with 19th, early 20th century architecture. You make these structures important parts of the book. You place the reader at the scenes as you describe the interior of these great buildings and rooms as if we were inside them. I believe that's important as well, not just to bring us into the story, but to show the readers, especially of today, the younger readers, that there was real care into the design and the detail of some of these great buildings of the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th century.
Now we do take the children in their quest to find the notebook, move along the Upper West Side. They see different monuments. They talk about the different monuments, the history of the different monuments. They talk about the architecture of the Upper West Side, the Beaux-Arts building. Houdini's house itself is a masterpiece of brownstone architecture from the turn of this last century. And they wonder whether that could have played anything into where the notebook had been hidden. They ultimately decide that, his house had already been built, so probably didn't, that there were probably no clues in the architecture of the home. But they found some things that were intriguing in the house that led them to be able to discover his notebook within the home. There's an entire, throughout the book, we try to blend what was real events and places and people in our life growing up, that they were part of the inspiration for this tale. And we want to make it difficult at times while the reader's reading this book to know, well, where does the reality end and the fantasy of this tale begin? Or did it all really happen, perhaps, because so much of it really did happen to us? You know, we had the subsidiary characters in the book, like the Gibsons, were real people and played an important part. His wife was also a magician and a fortune teller. She read palms. She reads the children's palms and understands that they're special and might have special abilities. The neighborhood that we lived in had actors in the building. Our Paul Tripp, who did children's shows, was there. Eli Wallach was part of the committee. He lived maybe 10 blocks away on Riverside Drive. He had known my dad in the Army. Eartha Kitt was in the penthouse. Artie Shaw was actually not only just a musician, but when he sort of left the musical world, he left it to study math. We bring that out in the book. These people had other lives that were often in fields that were science and could contribute to this special occult group of good people who were trying to decipher these codes to use them for the good of mankind. So you have—
And then Charlie? Can I interrupt? I don't know if when we went in and out, if you mentioned it, but I think very important, our mother was actually a cryptographer in World War II. So
that's someone who deciphers
not
codes.
Only knowledge. Yes, she really knew her stuff and had a collection on cryptography as well at home. All of this is based on real people, real things. And some things are real and some aren't. I think when you were talking about architecture, for instance, the part that takes part in St. John the Divine, a very impressive cathedral in New York, and the library, that's fantasy. It's not there.
In the book, there is a repository of all this great knowledge that's in a deep hidden library beneath the Cathedral of St. John the Divine. And we incorporate the building. There was difficulty building the building historically that they needed for a cathedral that size. It's, I think, the third largest cathedral in the whole world, that they needed to have the foundation on bedrock. And they kept digging and digging, and it was getting more and more expensive. And they were going to move it somewhere else. And J.P. Morgan stepped in and said, "No, I'll pay for it." And we used that as Morgan was part of this occult group that he wanted to to have a deep space below the cathedral that could be that no one would know about, and they could use the building of the cathedral to conceal this special space where people could meet and study these master texts.
I could go for that. That sounds like a place to meet. I'm in.
Yeah.
I do want to ask you, by the way, since I have you here, and the story is about bringing Harry Houdini back to life. Let's say you were part of a seance that was actually successful, and Harry Houdini comes back, at least for a brief moment or two. What would both of you like to ask him?
I think we've imagined where he's been in the book, and there's a description where he tries to relate it,
describe it
that, you know, if you are able to go skin diving or snorkeling, you're able to see a whole nother world that you wouldn't normally imagine existed unless you ever had that experience. And so he equates it to something like that where he's been. I would want to know, you know, what's it like?
Yeah. Exactly.
I understand you have plans for a sequel.
We thought that we weren't ready to let go of him. So.
So
because the book in itself is complete, but we thought that no, there's got to be more, and we're in the process of seeing exactly where that's taking us, or taking him, so, or taking all of us.
You become friends with your characters, and it is difficult to let them go, and you keep imagining, well, what are they doing next? Because of that, we just said, well, it's natural for this to continue. And the publisher, wanted a sequel. So we had no problem agreeing with that.
I'm looking forward to finding more about the sequel and having you back on when it comes out. I want to thank both of you for coming on with us. The book is Houdini's Last Handcuffs. Where can our listeners find more information about the book?
We do have a website, easy to remember if you remember the title of the book, HoudinisLastHandcuffs.com. There are little buttons on that first page on the handcuff on the website Amazon is there, Barnes & Noble's also a button for your favorite indie store. So you can go online and purchase the book now. It was just released this past month to coincide actually with Houdini's 150th anniversary of his birth, which was March 24th, just occurred. So it's an anniversary celebration, and the book is available online through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your favorite indie store.
Mm-hmm.
Once again, the book is Houdini's Last Handcuffs. My guests, Charles and Cheryl Young, thank you very much for being with us on Book Spectrum. And thank you all for listening. I'm Chris Gordani, your host, and keep those pages turning.